It's a great pleasure for me to return here. I have to say that these exercises to dialogue about all the vast intricacies of black hole data with all of you theorists are, I think, one of the most important things I do, other than try to keep the Ulstein monitor from self-destructing or something like that. So I really appreciate it. It's a great vehicle to organize thoughts in a complex environment to field questions from all of you people and try to work, you know, in tandem to see if we can solve some problems and take advantage of this great opportunity we have to live in the early 2000s. So this talk resembles in many ways the talk I gave here in May. I'm going to try to give it in different order, and I've included some new things that are more tutorial style to try to just make it easier for all of you to cope with the literature, which is, as most complex observing fields, is very full of jargon and complex data. So I'm going to spend hardly any time on any introduction. I'm going to talk about X-ray states and QPOs. I'll try to review what our definition of X-ray states is, why we think it's important, how it differs from other observers' definitions of X-ray states, but try to convince you in the end that we're all really speaking about the same fundamental facts, and it's more of a problem of language rather than the message content that we're trying to give to you. I'll talk about the properties of low-frequency QPOs, also the properties of high-frequency QPOs, and I'll make a few statements about what I think are observational challenges for jet theory and GR-MHD, and I'll also go beyond and characterize a few ways that even in the observer community we may be able to improve our understanding of what is going on with these systems and how we can deliver meaningful constraints to those trying to model black hole accretion. So this is just an advertisement that I think in the broadest sense, in the science that we do for black holes, we want to first locate them using X-ray astronomy. We want to measure the black hole properties and understand accretion physics. And in the broadest sense, this is what we're after, is why we study, are engaged in the science. And I'll try to make the case that QPOs really help us with with the mysteries in two of these properties. In particular, whether QPOs can eventually help us to constrain the spin of the black hole with high-frequency QPOs, and whether both types can help us understand accretion physics. That's some metric that we need to have in the model because the QPOs are there and they're important. I'll talk at the end a little bit about the primary variables. Many of you, and questions from Julian this morning, are trying to address and get a sense on what other than mass and the spin and the tilt of the disk, the tilt of the disk with respect to the angular momentum of the black hole, the accretion rate, whether there's an outflow, whether there's a global magnetic field, whether the plasma beta value, issue of gas to magnetic pressures is itself some kind of fundamental variable. And there are lots of reviews that I would encourage you to look at that have come online, at least on AstroPH, largely in response to Walter Lewin trying to refresh his book. In terms of the properties of black hole binaries, I just want to leave a couple of impressions. First of all, we need your support from the observing side for continuing missions, because most of the opportunities that we have in black hole binary astrophysics come from transient systems. Here's the current summary for dynamical black hole binaries. We have 20 of them in the LMC and Milky Way, and 17 are transients. For black hole candidates, which look like black holes in every sense in terms of X-ray radiation, but we don't have the dynamical measurements looking at the radial velocities of the companion star, we have 21, and 20 are transients. So these have great bearing on the continuity of NASA and ESA and Japanese functions for observing on the timeline. And the best strategy, if we can afford it as scientists of Earth, is to fill the timeline as densely as possible with both all-sky monitors and missions that can do timing studies. The danger is that we're perilously close to having no future, and that's something that we should all think about as a community and which would be hurt. I start off a lot of these talks with the comfort zone of Newtonian gravity, where the observations of the companion star lead to meaningful measurements of the mass. And we know enough about the binary systems where we can make a scale drawing, as done by Jerry Orris here, maintained on his website, for the sizes of the binaries, all to scale, the color of the companion star in terms of the surface temperature, and the tilt of the system in terms of our estimates of the inclination angle. And this gradual evolution of a secure base from which to approach black hole binaries is fundamental to allow us to then to take on the more challenging issues pertaining to the mysteries of X-ray radiation and effects of general relativity.
Yep. Is there a selection reason why a lot of these are seen at fairly high inclinations? Is it just coincidence?
Yeah, I don't know that anyone has shown that it's statistically anomalous. I mean, if you just weight, you know, the statistically what random pole angles should have on the sky, then you're favored to look at the 60 degree zone inclination and not the 30 degree zone, that's for sure, and then things are following that pattern. So I don't think there's a problem. There is a consensus that we're getting it right. For instance, there's observing parameters tend to be coupled. In cases where the inclination angle is only 45 or 50 degrees, based on binary analyses, those are the same sources where we have to put a reflection term into the X-ray modeling to get the spectrum right. So I think there's plenty of comfort factor in that these numbers are basically correct. So in other words, high systems that are more pole on, like GX339, SeqX1, one called 1354-64, we see them in more than one parameter, the binary and inclination and reflection. But you're right, though. We do see many more at grazing than we do pole on, but I don't think we have enough of a sample to make any claims about anomalies. So here's how the X-ray transients present themselves. The top, which we had a little intro to this morning, the ASM light curve, where up until a certain point, often we don't even know about the source in the history of astronomy, and then all of a sudden, bang, it starts doing things, and an outburst is very bright. You can get a lot of meaningful data in a camera that has a collecting area just about this big, which is like the All-Sky Monitor effective area. It's quite dramatic, and these sources can go from invisible even to large observatories. Some have Chandra and XMM upper limits, all the way to being the rank order third or fourth brightest X-ray source in the sky in the matter of a couple of days. And we've learned that these are the black hole binaries that we love to study. And in the bottom panel here, I've taken the, and I will do this routinely in this talk, I will have taken pointed RXTE observations of the same source when they occur in a quantized fashion and show you the the model flux now and symbol coding the data point to show you how I would classify it in terms of states. So we're just getting back the light curve here. You can see these two curves track each other very well. The ASM count rate certainly functions as an X-ray bolometer to first order. Didn't come out so well here, but the triangles, which are colored green, represent what I'll call the steep power law state. The red X's, think of as red as some thermal emission. It's just a thermal state, basically dominated by thermal component from the accretion disk. The hard state in these diagrams is a square colored blue. And the intermediate states are circles, which here are colored yellow, and later I will try to break them out into different types of intermediate states. But you can see from this source, there's a two-wave outburst. The first wave, which is punctuated by steep power law flares that interrupt the thermal state, and then the second wave of the outburst is pretty much all thermal. Now, so I'm going to quickly define what these states are, And then I'm going to show you how they represent themselves in the two basic ways that are interesting to look at in terms of state diagrams. And then finally, I will talk more about the QPO properties and what are the ways that we might solve the mechanism for both low frequency and high frequency types. So here's the thermal state. This is the state that was expected and based on theoretical grounds that matter would flow in toward the compact object and have to get rid of angular momentum on the way in and produce essentially a thermal spectrum that would be loaded toward the inner rings before the matter either will hit the compact object and form a boundary layer or will disappear into an event horizon in a black hole in the general relativity paradigm. Now, in reviewing the XTE data, the goals of this set of state definitions are to use both energy spectra and power density spectra to make use of the full XTE archive whenever possible, and to try to incorporate the thrust of the old definitions to the extent possible while correcting some of the terminology that seemed to be misleading. And one big problem we were trying to solve here is that all of the terminology was highly jargonistic and sort of had its own observer relativity, so that all the words were low, high, hard, soft, all that kind of stuff. And so it didn't impart any physical meaning, and one of the goals here is to try to lay it out in those terms. I don't think there's anything that has to be permanent about this. The main punchline that we're trying to give in proposing these definitions is it's a better vehicle for focusing attention on the physical processes that need explaining than one would get by this old jargon that was full of confusions and inappropriate words. So we define the thermal state, and we just make some ad hoc definitions of the boundaries so as to incorporate distributions. I mean, that's basically what this is all about. In the sense that there's a thermal state that has a certain stability locus and a range of parameters, we're trying to capture that in some multi-parameter space to advertise when that happens and make some cuts and warn people that if it's not that, it may be intermediate or it may be a different state. So on our definition, in the thermal state, we want the disk to have at least 75% of the flux in the range of 2 to 20 keV. We want the RMS, the integrated power in the power spectrum, to be less than 0.075. We normalize our power density spectra one step beyond Leahy, where we express the power in terms of RMS amplitude divided by the mean, all that quantity squared per hertz. So if you integrate between 0.1 hertz and 10 hertz, and come up with this RMS number, the bulk of all what we would call thermal states, or what anyone would look at and say is a thermally dominated spectrum, fall in this zone here, which means there's a moderate amount of flickering, but there's not a tremendous amount of continuum variability. If it goes past this number, we warn you by putting it in a different state, intermediate state, or some other state. Yep.
There's a little too much parallax from my point of view. Estimate the slope of the power density spectrum.
It's close to F minus 1. So this power continuum here that Julian was asking about is basically, in a rough sense, consistent with the idea of 1 over F turbulent flow that is found to be present very widely in many types of physical systems.
On that note, though, so Kristen was trying to convince me while she was here that even here, the photons that are coming from the thermal thing, the nominal accretion disk, are not producing this variability. That it's still the hard component at the end of that. Is that correct?
Okay. By saying that this is less than this, then I allow this to be arbitrarily low. I can show you a whole assortment of thermal states that will press the limit and start to show some curvature as it's trying to head toward a hot, more highly variable state than usual for thermal. But I think the basic common thermal spectrum is 1 over F. On the other hand, I can show you cases where this thermal component in the spectrum dominates at a very high level, and you start teasing the range towards zero power. So in our definition of a thermal spectrum, and this includes taking in light where the red curve dominates the light. So if I make the power density spectrum between 2 and 5 keV, then that would draw a box here, and I'd say, well, let's integrate under the red curve, which is the thermal spectrum, and under the blue curve. And so there are many times when here I'm dominated by the thermal component in the energy spectrum, and I have a nice 1 over F with a... No, generally a little less amplitude.
Because I think that's the same.
Okay.
If you computed the power spectrum from, say, 2 to 4 kilovolts and 4 to 6 and so on,
yes,
would the amplitude have an upward trend?
It would. Upward trend with KEB.
Right.
I thought you were questioning whether or not this thing was entirely due to the blue portion of the spectrum.
That's what I was suggesting, basically.
Yes, that is was manifestly not true.
Okay. So it's not purely, but there is a trend.
So if there can be turbulent flow 1 over F at the level of, say, 3 or 4%, just at 2 to 5 keV, but on other days, it can be much less, and I can even show you a couple of spectra. They're rare. So a couple of spectra of 1630-47 where there's almost no intrinsic power. It almost gets to that point of being, you know, sunshine with not anything but Poisson noise in the data. But that's rare. This is much more the usual thing you get. Okay, so this is the sun when it's yellow, following up on that analogy from this morning. So I've moved the yellow sun up and made room for the sun when it's purple. And so in this state, the hard state, there's a very different energy divide between the thermal component in red and the power law in blue. It's power law dominated, and in fact we require for the hard state that the fraction of the disk at 2 to 20 keV be less than 0.2. Or we warn you by throwing it at intermediate. When you fit this to a power law, there are times when a single power law will do. There are times when a broken power law is preferred. And we gauge the slope of the power law spectrum by the first index if there are two indices. And this is the range that we advertise. The canonical value, right, the heritage is that, well, quote, there's very little disk flux, quote, and the power law is twiddle 1.7. So we're just trying to be a little more rigorous here about what our definitions are so that I can follow a recipe and show you things self-consistently in any format that you want. And oh, this? Iron. Where there's a dotted line here, then I've been motivated, chi-square reasons, to put in a broad iron line into the fit. And this particular one has it. But you can see here where the blue departs from the total spectrum. And this is this little wedge, and that's what's being contributed to by the disk in this case. And usually when you go deep into the hard state, you cannot see the disk with XT pointing at you. So the temperatures will be below half a keV. That's as far as we can make a statement with XT. The power density spectrum has this very different shape, expressed in p nu versus nu units. This has been variously called as was frequently called band-limited noise. The power is flat out to a certain frequency, and it drops sharply to higher frequency. This is a characteristic of the hard state. It's always seen. And when you integrate the power, you get a much higher number than you do otherwise. And that's why we have a requirement here that the RMS be greater than 0.1. The RMS can often be 0.2, 0.3. And you can see very heavy flickering at 1 hertz, because 1 hertz is in the flat power zone, sometimes even near the peak of the function when you express it in terms of nu. Log nu times p nu. So these are just some recipe numbers to try to isolate the hard state. And as I was saying before, it's pretty well demonstrated now, or at least it's the paradigm I would dare to say, that there's a steady jet in the hard state.
Sorry, just another question. So if you did that in mu at mu, it would be sort of triangular here, you know, that one first.
Yes, and I'll show you some of those at the end.
The slope on the high frequency side of the QPO in the hard state.
It's steeper than 2, and it the issue of what happens in a discrete Fourier transform when you just stop giving new power is that it bleeds away. It doesn't go like a step function. And there's a desire to get dead time calibrated well enough to really look at this issue in the hard state. The problem is you have to go out and cover zones above 100 hertz, where dead time effects are important. So we actually have a new wave of PCA dead time studies going on this summer to really work hard to go past, to go down to levels that are 0.1% in terms of the fractional variability. The work of Rybnitsev and Siniaev, looking at high frequency and using their dead time model, they have claims that there are systematic differences between black holes and neutron stars in the sense that the cutoff comes earlier in frequency for neutron stars than for black holes. And a lot of their data that they're concerned with is the hard state. But there's still work to be done to really look at this carefully for all the states individually and try to figure out if there are trustable ramifications. But this looks steeper than Newton minus 2. Well, I think I remember 2.5, something like that, but then you have to worry about, well, how will it bleed off in the great Fourier transform with no intrinsic slope? But it's steep.
And is the slope more or less the same on both sides?
This is a little anomalous, and this disconnect from the corner happens when you have more of a mixture. Very often, especially at high luminosity, this thing will sit right on the boundary. So detachment from the boundary, in terms of where the QPO sits relative to the continuum break, is more unusual than it is common. And there are many sources, even neutron stars. Cirsnus X1 does this. That whole thing peels back and forth with a little QPO riding on the break continuously.
The break always in those cases is the peak in new P mu.
For that source, yes. This shows it's not necessary in always, because you want to put the break right here. But then it's hard to know. You know, a lot of people will say, well, wait a minute, maybe that's its own discrete component. Maybe there's a one thing that goes like that. So the black art of multi-Lorentzians of arbitrary width then starts to percolate into the room, and I would refer all the questions to Mike Nowak.
The aliasing problem that you mentioned. Come on. The aliasing problem you mentioned means that determining the shape of the QPO feature is always
going to be driven. Well, wait, not of this QPO feature.
You
go far.
If the power is declining very steeply on the high frequency side, mm-hmm. then I thought that's exactly the issue, because you have to worry about how much is the decline of leakage and how much is change in power. And so the genuine QPO will be spread out to high frequencies by the aliasing.
Well, no, I don't think that's true. You let this feature ride on a local continuum. Now, how are you going to make the local continuum? You can try, from first principles, to dissect this thing entirely into a set of features, including a bunch of Lorentzians of that are very broad. and then you'll try to model this as one feature. But these QPOs have such a high Q value that I don't see a large source of error. When you're trying to say, well, how much area is there under the curve in log space now, right? Sitting on top of the underlying continuum. I don't see that the modeling for the underlying continuum is all that sensitive issue. And in fact, when we model this, we prefer a local curved continuum. We don't try to model all the features.
Well, I wasn't speaking about the area under the curve, but the shape of the high frequency tail.
Okay. Yes.
And that will be some mixture of window function and reality.
Right. No, so you come back to Dave's question. Yeah. No, that's why I was saying it's a hard question. And you're right. I didn't quite spell out that way, but it's got dead time effects you have to worry about.
But you're always involving the transform window function with the real transform.
Right. But on the other hand, if there's a 200 hertz difference between black holes and neutron stars, then we need to look anyway to see if the reality is larger than our fears of the uncertainties of how you... And plus, you can model the effect. You can take model data and send it through the same software and bound what the bleed is. So this has the jet, and let's call this for fun the purple sun, when the jet is active. And now there's an interesting debate going on about where does this come from? What is the nature of this power spectrum, and where does this energy spectrum come from? And there's a quite lively debate between still the ADF people, the inverse Compton people, and the synchrotron people, even for the same source, and even when the column density is low, allowing you the most visible portion of a broad frequency spectrum that we can get, spectral energy distribution. But there's still many things to do. I think this is a healthy debate. It's not stuck forever. There will be polarization measurements done of these sources by us or Canada in the next, I don't know, probably 10 or 15 years. So this will get resolved, but right now, I would have to say, is not resolved.
Sorry, can you explain what this jet actually is, since we heard of different types of jets, sporadic jets? So what exactly defines it also morphologically?
This is what we're calling the steady jet that can persist, and we gauge it as being steady both in terms of the X-ray emission properties and the radio properties. It can last for some number of days to months, and it's steady in a rough sense. I mean, everything is sort of percolating at some level, 10% or 15%. But it doesn't have a lot of variability, and it doesn't have, often within a month, all that much secular change. Just minor secular changes that might have to do with its onset and its termination. But the two key measurements that support the idea are there are a sample of a few, two or three, cases where they've been able to do VLBI radio measurements when a source was in one of these states, and they see non-symmetric emission. Big X1 looks to be a little line on the sky. It's a rough line, and does not compel a jet interpretation. You have collimated outflow of order 10 or 20 degrees. I don't think the SIGX1 observations are sufficient to say that kind of an outflow model is prohibited. But in the case of GRS-1915, there are many observations in what look to be its version of the hard state, which is clearly a jet at all spatial scales, even down to AU size spatial resolution. Now, if you feel that it's natural to buy those observations, then you're stuck with a jet that is much more collimated than just a generalized outflow.
Why is that?
Because it's unresolved at all scales between AU size and 1,000 AU.
In unresolved in width.
Yeah. Right.
Is there any indication whether this is really uniform along the jet, or whether
the part two is, uniform along the jet?
Meaning that, is it like lobs being ejected?
Yeah, we at the level of 20 or 30%, there's no indication at all, but that's statistics limited. Because you're taking a moderate radio beam and dissecting it spatially, so you can't produce very strong limits on the lack of condensations along the jet.
Ron, in this variable state here, thinking about this inverse Compton or synchrotron thing, has there been any attempt, or is it possible to go looking for the energy-dependent time delays that are supposed to be characteristic of compensation?
That whole effort ran aground almost as soon as they started doing it, because the time delays are thick.
I mean, given the amount of compensation that's needed, the lags would be very long?
No, given the observed lags, the sizes of the clouds are gigantic. Makes no sense. You would, at those sizes, all the other things are uncomfortable. You'd start seeing suppression of high frequency behavior well before you really do. So it ushered people into a different mindset about how to interpret phase lags. And that this is the current thinking for both the continuum and QPOs. You can measure phase lags easily, shockingly easy. They can be positive or negative, the QPOs. That kills compensation. Well, I mean, they measure them in terms of hard lags. So they expect a positive hard lag. If your QPO can flip negative in terms of now suddenly the soft X-rays are lagging, then that's pretty uncomfortable. For the power continuum, it's generally a lag, but it's too big. So people start thinking of, okay, well, you have a mechanism. You have a black box that's squirting out relativistic electrons. And you don't know exactly how you're exciting this black box. You don't know its geometry, and you're having trouble understanding how to make the whole black box work in a meaningful way. But you have the added opportunity to create spectral variations in what's being squirted out. That pump, right, that's squirting the energetic electrons out of your black box doesn't have to be gray. There's no a priori reason for that. So we can be reading in the phase lags the pump action. And more specifically, for QPOs, we can be reading just the spectral evolution of the waveform that will create a phase lag. It has nothing to do with sizes and geometries anymore. Now we're back to the creationism part of the QPO or the power continuum in a Compton model. But I think the first observation of SIGX-1, where they tried to do all this, they got giant clouds and everyone went, oh no, this is horrible.
So blaming it all on the source can be made comfortable with either an inverse Compton or a synchrotron model for the formation spectrum.
None of these, I don't think, has a natural explanation of this. And part of my fun lately is to try to export this as saying, okay, if you buy this for the jet, then how come you're not buying that for the jet? Because when the jet goes away, and I'll talk more about this, this whole thing caves and goes away. So I see this as the wave action of a steady jet. So it will be something to try to match. If you, getting ahead of myself, but if you get down to where you start to create now some simulations or whatever, where you think you're in the right configuration and you're supporting the magnetic fields that might give you a steady jet, well then what other kind of associated wave action do you get? And can you possibly bridge to this? If you could, you would get lots of fans. who doesn't want to follow this to the next step, and you know, let's keep going and see if this looks like a solved, done deal. But I would, that's one of the punchlines of the talk, is I will advertise this as a timing signature for the jet. So this is the jet state, and the final state now, I've moved the two down, so here's purple sun and the yellow sun, here's the white sun. The white sun has this power law. And I've chosen a day when the power law dominates. It doesn't have to be this dramatic to dwarf the disk by, you know, an order of magnitude at the minimum point in any frequency zone. But it can do this, so I like to show this because it just shows that something extraordinary happens here. And this, in fact, is a day when it was observed by Ossie, and the limit for the extent of this power law is of order 700 keV. So it just fills a whole bunch of electromagnetic spectrum with this power law with an index of 2.5, and that's why it might be fun to call it the white sun. And when this comes alive, we generally see QPOs that pop up with as many as three frequencies. There's one at 0.1 hertz, another one around 8 hertz, and then our friend over here at 300 hertz. So these timing modes and this energy spectrum, I would claim, are significant departures from a thermal configuration. So significant, we should give it its own state label and focus some attention onto it and spend some of our time looking at our disk models and trying to tweak them into understanding what's going on, but yet not trying to bury this as a subdivision of the accretion disk. And that is the main bone of contention between the people who like this steep power law state prescription and those people who followed the path of the very high state versus those that want to unify all of these and call it the soft state. Point here being that if you consider the power law a natural consequence of an accretion disk, and other than some extremely weak atmospheric thermal compensation, I don't see where it's natural at all. And in fact, I can show you data where there is none. But even if you try to buy this power law component as just something subordinate to the accretion disk so as to unify all these things, then it's very troublesome to me when the tail is really wagging the dog and giving you all of these QPO features at very disparate frequencies. So that is the main bone of contention between this prescription of states and some other prescription of states, such as particularly Tommaso Bologna, who would be very happy just calling both of these together the soft state. Now, why? What one thing that is troublesome to many people trying to model data is when you're forced to do this deconvolution, you have to grab a spectrum and go into XSpec and choose your model. And there's a block. There's a mental block and a sort of a physics block with that process. If you've ever played with XSpec before, it's also a bit of a black art, and it's not as easy and deterministic a button that you can press as some other analyses. What other things are you going to include in your model? Do you need reflection? Do you need a broad iron line? There are lots of choices that you make. What's the correct column density? Do you leave the column density fixed or flat? These choices annoy a lot of people, but the first order thing is still, what do you choose for a model? In our prescription, we try to sneak between these obstacles by choosing a decoupled prescription for the thermal component and the non-thermal component. You just say that this is a disk black body. Did it. And in complete isolation, this is a power law, which can become a broken power law if chi-square is not happy with the first prescription. And you just let it run in an uncoupled sense, and you see what you get later. It's sort of an agnostic way to approach X-ray spectra, and a lot of observers are uncomfortable doing that. My only claim is that it's rather generic, and it is uncoupled, and you can get a lot out of doing that. The alternative is to select a specific compensation model. Once you do that, you're a slave to that geometry. If you don't know the geometry, and the thing has some uncomfortable things like QPOs and things like that, then you're forced to interpret it inside that paradigm. So for a spectrum like this, my Y compensation parameter is going to be in the zillions, because I've got to have, I have to have enough scatterings to create these very hard photons out here. On the other hand, I can still see the disk. So I have to allow some degrees of freedom. The tail is wagging the dog here, and the optical depth looking through this stuff to see the disk is not the same optical depth for any thermal compensation model that I have to have to get these hard scatters. So you start seeing people start out with a slab model which doesn't do the QPOs, and then they have to invoke partial covering because they want this to leak out enough to be able to still see it, although they're forcing the Compton model to have the thing engulfed in a major way if 90% of the light is coming out in the power law.
I'm lost by what you just said. What did the presence of QPOs have to do with the spectral decomposition?
That was an aside. Oh. Sorry. The problem with the model is that when you start coupling, you start making geometric choices. And then as an aside, and I said, and I'm uncomfortable with the current geometric choices for Compton scattering, given that there are things in the data, like QPOs, that seem to make no sense in the standard slab model. A static slab model has no QPOs in it, it just sits there. So that was only an aside. Forget I said that. Coming back to this, the mechanics of the spectral fit, you have to do a lot of things to make any model fit this, and for cases like this, you're gonna have to start uncovering a portion of the spectrum, because the scatters out here and the visibility of the disk through the stuff don't seem to match. Now, I'm just reading what people do, right? I've been an agnostic for a long time, so I've been avoiding a couple of models for a long time. On the other hand, doing it this way doesn't say compensation's wrong. It just tries to look at things in terms of sloppy functions so that you can ask the question later, how do they couple? Which is coming up later. I can do it in a generic fashion and ask the question. If I use a specific compensation model, I've already given it away any rights to investigate whether and how these two components couple with each other. So it's not just us doing that. I mean, the Kubota investigations have a lot of that element in them, where they'll iterate their model through a bunch of phases where they start looking at it, seeing how the temperature and this property start to curve over, and explore that further in terms of compensation. But on the other hand, there are some very specific models that are very stiff and rigorous, and once you've made your selection and start using that, then it's an uncoupled world. But we're finding this at this point in time a vehicle for progress, I would only argue. You can start to make sense and see the patterns if you take a generic approach. And the generic approach looks at these things decoupled. But to get the parameter, if I'm asking people to classify based on these parameters, I'm forcing them to do this. Because how else are they going to know if the fraction of the disk over the total is less than 0.2 or greater than 0.75 or whatever is relevant to the specific state that they're questioning? And forcing people to do what they are uncomfortable doing creates some tension, and that's why, in part, why this solution to the complexity of black hole spectra is not universally recognized as a good idea. But the consequence of looking at these two as one state, to me, is a horrible idea. So this debate continues about then what to do. And I'm trying to find the right model, so I'm quite comfortable with allowing these to proceed in an uncoupled fashion. But then I'm stuck in defining them that way and forcing people to follow my path, or they can't talk to me about how they would classify the stuff. So these are the behind the scenes. So Tommaso just doesn't like all this stuff. He thinks it's basically conservation. Chris Doan doesn't particularly like all this stuff either. She thinks it's all conservation too. But in a very friendly way, if I say to Chris, well, what about these QPOs? She'll just, you know, take a deep breath and go, oh, you know, those damn QPOs. So, you know, stop talking about that. So it's sort of not a done deal. And she, I think, admitted a few weeks ago that, you know, the partial covering, yes, it's necessary for her in cases like this. And it comes with a certain amount of discomfort that, well, maybe we don't have it quite right.
Sorry, is the issue that if you have all this comfortization going on and it completely covered over the disk, you couldn't see the QPO coming up from the disk?
Or because why do you even see the disk? See, okay, let me try to be more specific about what I have in mind here. I have a little spectrum here that's a thermal spectrum, and I have some continentization that's a natural consequence. I'll play everything is soft and I don't even care anymore. And so what I measure here in red is largely what is there, right? Because continentization is weak and it's adding 10%. Okay? Now, I move up to this. To create a tail like this, I've got to create a huge monster of a thermal component. And one of the problems with the standard condensation model is if I'm going to try to scatter the things up really high and make this spectrum be totally dominated by what used to be the tail, then I have to have a lot of scatterers. And if I then impose both the fact that I still see the disk through these scatterers, and I can't see QPOs through this, it doesn't create, I don't think.
Let's understand, Peter. A steep power law in the computation model is a symptom of a relatively small lot.
How do you?
Yeah, in a thermal compensation model, you require high temperatures to get up to those high energies, but you don't.
That's right. Small optical depth and high temperature would produce that.
Well, I think it depends what zone you're modeling, but they're trying to model the broadband energy distribution out to several hundred keV. And so, if you look at their attempts, what they say in their papers is they need many scatters.
Well, but many scattering is not the same thing as large optical depth.
I think there may be another. I'm not sure about this, but they may also be trying to attenuate the disk spectrum, which would require a large optical depth.
Yes, but Ron is saying also that, quote, you see the disk through it. Now, what do you mean by see the disk through it? What is that? Is an operational statement?
Okay, I'm not making these models, and I'm not fitting these models. So I may be saying it wrong, but what I'm doing is I'm reading what they're doing and I'm trying in my own way to explain what I think it is that they're doing.
I'm trying to understand what your words see through.
Yes.
What does that mean?
What it means to me is there's a certain probability of a photon from the disk getting to my detector. Just to start with, okay? Right. And then it depends on the model, right? Because what you need is you need to have a self-consistent solution so that what you think you're starting with and the scatters that you need to create both of these components are self-consistent.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, the speed power law is like that. In the condensation, in the thermal condensation, tells you that the constant y is relatively small. The fact that you're sent to high energy, so the temperature is fairly high, which means the optical depth is quite small. So there's no problem seeing a dip through it.
Well,
right, and then I think the problem is the relative normalization.
Yeah,
right.
That's the subject.
Yeah. What tau is needed to get that top left? A compensation model that fits that top left.
I'm worried that you're.
Okay, but see, this is not a question for me.
Yeah.
If I'm misspeaking, then I will try to understand.
I think your approach approach is that you have a two-component
yes.
model and you're just
yeah.
doing these.
What I see is the people using what they consider to be the standard model for computation are running into difficulty normalizing both spectra, and they start talking about needing a covering fraction. What I interpreted, and perhaps misspoke, is that the need for a covering fraction meant that the optical depth as measured between the scattering world and the visibility of the disk was not matching. So I'm then likely not saying it quite right, but the punchline for me is that I don't like the idea of partial covering. I don't think that it confirms the model. And if I'm saying something wrong, I'm sorry for that, but ask Chris, because she's much more of an expert in these issues.
Two unrelated questions. One is, what is the covering fraction that they like to use? And secondly, the other question has to do with, you know, it's a two low frequency.
I don't even remember what the covering fraction is.
Okay, fine. The two low frequency QPOs, do they sit at those frequencies, or do they move around?
They move around.
They move around a lot.
Yeah. And this 0.1 hertz is rare. It's often not there at all. And this one this one moves around, but it moves around much more in the intermediate states than it does in the pure steep power loss.
And the 300 hertz one is safe.
Yeah. No, it's not always detectable.
But the frequency
is 300. Yes, within 15%. I think that is even going to withstand the test of the current outburst in the source. Jeroen Homan has a whole bunch of data, and the first QPO he saw was not exactly this, 300. But it was in our number of 15%, and then things
okay.
moved in.
I suggest we've got Ron here all week, and we can continue these, questioning him about these details during the morning discussion. So, yeah, let's...
Okay, so I do want to make it clear what we do, though, and why there is contention in what we do. But we're taking a pragmatic approach that I can give you far more conclusions if I do this than if I don't, and I give up. So here's our, so you want to have cartoons, you have a standard disk model, you have the hard state has jets, and then drawing this is everyone's homework assignment. Tomorrow at 11, we want to see all the results. I will collect them. So, this may be slightly out of order, but getting into this whole business of timing, QPOs are generally defined as having central frequency over full of half max greater than 2, and there are broad power peaks, and it really is a complicated world, but I still claim that it's not something that we expect to get for free, and it is where we have very big mysteries for non-thermal radiation from black holes. I think because the mysteries are so large, this has to be seen as a vehicle for getting the model correct. Because no one would have thought in the beginning that black holes could produce jets. And no one would have thought that there'd be an alternative non-thermal state that could have, by whatever mechanism, photons coming out above 800 keV, and perhaps if the Germans Comtel people are right out to 2 MeV. And so, given such a vast counterintuitive reality that we're trying to deal with here about energetics of accretion and matter being ripped out of the jaws of a black hole near its event horizon, I think QPOs are an asset because they have the potential to confirm the model that is most mysterious and most surprising. Now, broad power peaks have really, it's a tough art, but there's still a lot of unexplored territory. And Mark Kleinvold has a nice paper about high frequency broad power peaks. So a couple hundred hertz now features TCs in 1630-47. And so there's definitely a future to this. And here's just a day in the life of a QPO, just to impress you that something at 10,000 solar luminosity banging away so that you can see the individual waves is kind of a remarkable thing, and not something to be taken lightly. These are not, you know, as profoundly important as solar oscillations are in the micro percent regime, These are much, much larger and much more the zeroth order way the radiation is expressing itself on some days. We've done some early analysis on wave tracking. It's a bit of a maddening sport. There are only some sources where you can track the waves well enough to do this. It's a little bit annoying that sometimes you get slightly different answers depending on how you key on the wave to be able to peg its arrival time. But the first order look clearly in this paper that I don't think there's been any follow-up of is that it's a random walk. None of the couplings that you expect out of the common systems that you might think of as being QPO-like, like a reservoir system, like the leaky faucet model, right? Surface tension and where the water droplet forms might vary, and so you wait longer one time, but you also build up a bigger droplet. So you take a lot of data, you expect correlations between the inter-arrival time and the amplitude of the next wave. All the QPOs are blind to all that. You can think of the system as just drifting in some sense. And if you do any statistical, you know, autocorrelation functions, or it seems to solve to follow all of the prescriptions for a random walk. So it's another clue, but it's puzzling. I don't know what to make of it.
Random walk or random shots? Just think about the old shot noise model.
No, I mean. Well, the shot noise models are non-periodic, so they don't phase into this discussion. I mean, a random walk in terms of if you measure individual waves and you determine a local frequency, and you start to look at delta time between peaks or troughs, whatever you measure, versus amplitude. I think a random walk has the property of being uncoupled, uncorrelated, and the frequency, the local frequency, just drifts. It just drifts with both signs, and it has its own wave patterns, and they're not even the, if I take a transform of the frequency, it's all white. Meaning that there are not even any measurable time scales in the drift of the frequency. Now, I'm sure there's a much better mathematical definition of what a random walk is. Since 1997, I forgot all that stuff. And all I can do is give you a sense that the local frequency wanders. It wanders with no preferred time scales, and there's no correlation between interwave time and peak. So it's not like a dripping faucet. And it's not like, it's not anchored. It has that flavor. It's drifting freely. Doesn't care. So, now I'm going to get onto this business of how you represent states. So, here's some other light curves, and now I've done the same representation, thermal, hard, steep power law, intermediate. So, just like the first source, there's lots of non-thermal stuff in the first wave, but this is much more weighted toward intermediate behavior. And the second wave is mostly thermal. But the point we make here is you can draw any line here in flux. Now this is model flux, so I have the ability to take the bolometric component of anything. And by bolometric, I mean just the integral over the whole disk black body curve for that component. And I just decide to call bolometric power law 1 to 30 keV. You've got to set integration limits somewhere. We don't know a priori where they're going to be without taking on a specific model.
Where is the intermediate?
So here is several tenths. So this is about a tenth, Eddington. And if I draw a line at 0.02 Eddington, I can pick up every state that we see. It's green. Triangles, X's, circles, and squares, all within the same band of luminosity.
Is sort of two-peak pattern more common, or just happens that the two that you showed just have this?
The ones that go to really high luminosity seem to show this, but it's not that common. It's more common for XTE for some reason. I don't know.
common feature that the hard state is associated with the beginning and the end of the outburst?
Not totally unique, but common. Very common. Starts off squares and ends squares. That happens 80% of the time.
In this case, there's no squares at all in the middle.
Yeah, but I can show you one that does.
Okay.
Not many, but it can happen.
Are those two green horns examples of what you were talking about this morning?
No.
The flare at the beginning, the flare at the end?
No, because this is a huge amount of time, and it did not stay in the hard state in between the horns.
So when you say jet, it's speculated, not when you actually see anything that looks like a jet.
Oh, I forgot to say this part two of your earlier question. The times when they've done VLBI, they see a flat radio index on the days that they are looking at the jet. That flat radio index, just like in the compact jet extragalactic sources, has become the proxy for imaging. Now that's a bit of using patterns of observations, but that flat radio spectrum is very common and always is seen when the X-ray properties would determine an extended hard state. So what they saw in all of these cases is a flat radio spectrum. So in their mind, that was very strong motivation to say, yep, they had a jet. Radio emission went up and it had a flat radio spectrum, so it had a jet. So they're happy.
Even in the active, in the extragalactic sources, when you have those compact sources, when you look at high frequencies, you see steep spectrum halos. Does anyone look here at higher frequencies?
Well, these radios sources are transients and they could completely go away. So if you look at a bunch of ATELs or IU circulars or something in a given thing, in a given transient outburst, you'll see, we have some observations, it's 30 millijanskis, all the radio people are totally happy. Then less than 0.1 millijanskis from the VLA. And that'll continue for a while. And they'll say, look, it came up again. And sometimes in these intermediate states, they'll have some flux. But all through here, there could be 25 VLA measurements with 0.1 millijansky upper limits. So there's a dynamic aspect to all this stuff that excludes any halo persistent source that would become significant when they're seeing these things.
I'm just questioning, maybe there's no jet there, as much as I love jets.
Yeah, well,
you may see some optically thick core, but maybe there isn't really any jet.
Yeah, well, we need more imaging observations. But if you go read the Dawan paper on GRS 1915, I mean, that is a pretty convincing looking jet in the plateau state.
Just that one source.
Right. It's less convincing in ZX1.
So in both this slide and the previous slide, the flare, the very high luminosity parts of the model flux diagram were all in the steep power loss state.
Mm-hmm.
Is that always true when the subjects are transient?
It's common, but not always true.
Of course not.
And the next one, I think, shows...
Wow. It's always true that nothing was ever true.
Now here, this is a really healthy looking hard state turn on. And I'm really glad it did this, because it just took a lot of ambiguity out of the whole question of whether or not, what the range of allowed luminosities are for a given state.
Okay, but where's the Eddington, to ask Charles this question, where's the Eddington luminosity?
Yeah, I think they're almost all similar in that the peaks here are in the sort of 0.2 range. So this is GX339-4, a radio favorite. And one of the reasons is it does extended hard states. So we're talking about hundreds of days where it can just be percolating along at a very low level. So it's a good radio source to study, and it's the favorite. Plus, it's a very frequent outburst. And sometimes it doesn't go away. Like here, it didn't really go away. It lingered. But here, it really went away. And it was zero. And here again, it led up to something. And it just shows the willfulness. GX-339-4 has been around forever. It does pops, but you know, this was astonishingly bright compared to these. Got to a crab. It's been seen several times in the history of astronomy, but a crab like outburst is quite surprising.
Let me press you on that. So in that yeah, right there.
Yeah.
Where it's the thermal study. How much of this power law is present there? Is it a lot of power?
I'll come to that.
Okay.
That's one of the state diagram things.
Okay.
So here now is the same data, okay? Here's all the data on GX-339-4. All these 274 symbols down here. In time, the sense of states means it's how the machine works. So you should be able to collapse all time and represent them on some diagram that shows some kind of organized behavior and stability to make the claim of states. These looked wacky enough that there was a period of time when it was very discomforting and wondering, well, what's going to happen to states now after we are forced to digest all this stuff? So most of what I'm telling you is the response to save states from utter chaos. The radio favored way is, and the Amsterdam favorite way, is the color intensity diagram. So here's color, there's the intensity. This is the same 274 data points for GX-339-4 now. So that big rise in the hard state is these data points now. But other times, and here's intermediate states, and I made intermediate a little more complicated. Sorry for using color for this, but I made dark circles for intermediate between steep power law and hard, and purple ones for thermal to hard, and then these invisible ones continue to be shown in their thermal to steep power law. But really, they just connect the state. The steep power law lives in this band. The thermal lives in that band. So these circles are all between these states, and these circles are all between these. And there's only one circle that really looks like a hybrid of thermal and hard, this guy. All the rest are hybrids in the sense of their position on the diagram. This is a normalized hard color, which means that despite all the detector evolution and all the gain epochs for the PCA, it's normalized so the crab looks like a dot, a little fuzz ball, a dot smeared by statistics. So all these things then can be put on the same diagram. So this is the color intensity diagram, and it shows a lot of, you know, organized behavior. All the hard states all live in this band, but they certainly occupy a large range of luminosity. All the red X's, thermal states, live in this band at soft, and they are separated from the steep power law states. But again, everything seems to exercise almost the full range of luminosity, except that the hard state can go fainter than the other. But as Marek pointed out to us at one conference, there's no a priori law that says an accretion disk has to stop functioning at a certain low level of n dot. So likewise, we're forced to believe this is true for all of the states. And the task remains then to determine the hidden variables that separate the different states. And this is not a progression in m dot.
Okay, but looking just at the red dots, which is the thermal state. Up at the top, the red dots in the upper left corner is the fraction that's in a power law any different than the red dots that are down at the bottom? Are there any trends at all within the thermal state itself?
There is, and I'll show that to you. It's coming up still. This is just this color intensity configuration for looking at states.
I know we're not supposed to get time on this diagram, but if you connect all the dots, do you get any interesting trajectories?
Yeah.
Obviously those on the right.
Right, and that gave way to, that's what this thing is all about. This is this.
Uh-huh.
Okay? the statement that this source heavily influenced the unified radio model, I can reproduce their thing to first order by just looking at the data, doing my classification, and sticking it on the plot. Okay? It's heavily influenced by this. So this is not the turtle diagram, it's the GX339-4 diagram. It's important to realize that the angles can be different, the sort of, a lot of the structure can be different, the circulations can be different. This doesn't really have a sense of circulations the way some other sources do, and I'll show you some of them. But they're put in. But see, you can have a circulation here. So this would be like the flow of that steady hard state with the horns on both ends. That's one of these things. And the whole envelope of having an eruption that starts hard and ends hard is the outer loop that you go like this. And the outer loop does not have, generally, sharp outbursts at this point, but that should not think, you should not conclude by that that jets only form going in this direction because of these loops.
Okay, well, the diagram you showed this morning with the two flares at the end of the low hard state,
yeah,
the beginning and the end, that's not the outer loop then?
No.
Where is it on this diagram?
That's one of these little loops.
So it's not so hard that you're almost steep parallel. You're not really hard state. Is that right?
The transition. See, the overall light curve looked like it was high and then had a long dip and then came back up again. That whole thing was at a somewhat high hard state in luminosity, connecting to bright soft state. So what does that mean? It's high up in the hard zone, and it's connected to bright soft states, so it's one of these things. So if you're crossing from...
But you're hard, so you're...
Well, so this thing crossed first. We're following. We didn't follow the start of that outburst, right? That outburst did something, and we find ourselves one day over here. And we do that. Right? We really do this. It's a very tight loop. Because we stay in the hard state. Well, actually, we go all the way over here. So let me get that right.
Okay, so sorry, you do sorry. Go way over to the
You right go way over to the right-hand side.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I did that wrong. But it's not the outer loop like a whole outburst is. Sorry, it's a big loop like this. Now, I don't know why they didn't put one of those kinds of loops. I mean, it's their data that I was talking about. But this is this. Okay, so...
What is the bottom there?
What?
The bottom part?
Well, the bottom part is part of the radio thing. This is their scheme as to how the disk fraction and the jet... parameters should vary as a function of the position along here.
Okay, I can.
Yeah, so there's no disk here, there's lots of disk here, and then in their model, I forget which parameter this is, I can't read it off of the.
The red is a disk inner radius, so on the right, the disk has a big hole in it. And as you move toward the left, the disk inner radius gets smaller. Yeah. The right curve goes down.
That's their
interpretation.
Yes.
But I'll tell you what Fender, Bloy, and Gallo.
Yes.
Okay. And the blue is the jet speed, which in their model increases as this hole gets smaller, producing a more relativistic jet.
Right. Now, I'm not here to sell anything about this. It's just part of the figure that I'm trying to connect them to this world.
So is it true when you draw the jet line there, as we have had many versions, that you only get a jet when you cross this curve going up and to the left?
So all the blue jets?
You get a steady jet all here. Right. And you get decaying radio flux going in this direction. This direction, both. You get more inefficient. You can get real positive radio detections here, but if you measure something like the ratio of X-ray luminosity to radio luminosity, it's decaying going this way.
What about those loops?
These loops are just a circulation pattern that will allow a source to start to do some funny things in the middle of an outburst. You have to go back to the timing diagram. See, this one would be challenging. This is some kind of a loop, right? You start off in the hard thing, you go into the soft zones, and you come all the way back to the hard state, and then you go back into the soft zones, and you come back to the hard state again. So it's not just one circulation in a case like this. It's got a little loop inside that will revisit the hard state in the middle of an outburst. So they're aware of these kinds of things, and so they'll try to put them in the cartoon, help conceptualize that it's not just one circle, it has structure.
So there's nothing too seriously to be taken about the fact that when it enters this loop from the heart to the soft, it goes to this outburst case, and only when it travels out, but when it completes the loop coming back clockwise.
I think it's still valid to think of it in the following way. If the source is in this zone, it is extremely likely and would be shocking to the contrary that it's going to have a steady jet. If it stays in this zone, it's going to have radio emission, it's going to have radio, a flat radio spectrum, it's going to have hard state X-ray characteristics, and they're going to call it a jet if it's in this zone. When it's migrating toward the softer states, at the time it crosses this line, the jet line, that is an opportunity for a much higher probability of firing off a ballistic, very high beta outflow jet. That remains true.
High beta meaning high velocity.
Yes. That remains true. The details of what the jet looks like, I'm saying nothing about.
When it does the loop, comes back, it crosses the jet line again, but nothing happens there.
Yes, it does.
It does.
Every time it crosses the jet line, every single time,
either way, you get a
in either direction, you have the opportunity. It doesn't mean it has to happen every single time, but you have the opportunity, and it will happen some fraction of the time, to have a very intense radio flare, an associated X-ray flare, and they'll all go scurrying to do VLBI and see if it's big enough to have caused something detectable in terms of superluminal pellets coming out of the thing.
So basically, a jet is never launched except on the crossing of the jet line. Is that fair?
As far as I know, I think that's true.
So then, when it crosses the jet line back on the bottom of the outer loop, does it also launch bullets there?
No.
No.
But that may be a
selection effect. Exactly.
If there was physics in all this, you'd think, well, who knows?
No, they're...
you'd like it to be that you didn't see bullets on the crossing of the jet line on the lower outer loop as a selection effect, because you'd think, gee, if it could do it at the higher luminosity state when it was on the inner loop, why couldn't it do it on the lower luminosity state when it was on the outer loop? But who knows?
No, it may be doing it, and right. the time that that the radio astronomer is most hard-pressed to play ball here is when it's VLBI, both in terms of scheduling coverage, signal noise required to see anything, et cetera, et cetera. And the time for us is high-frequency QPOs. So we can tell you the best cases, but we have trouble telling you the complement in a way that makes you understand what the limits are for a model. Those two are the most hard-pressed cases, VLBI imaging and high-frequency QPO.
So this is this very soft power law at that point? I mean at the top, yeah?
Which?
When it crosses the jet line,
yeah? Yeah, the green, the triangle zone here. And what I claimed to provoke conversation at the Texas Symposium was that I could reproduce their diagram with a state-specific coding and show that where they say the jet line should be is a state line when you go from the intermediate state to the steep power loss state. And I have some data with Guy Pooley for GRS 1915 plus 105 that has the radio data and shows the same thing. That there's a state line jet line.
Sorry, the distinction between a target state and state parallel state is...
I'll show you that. Now, this didn't come out dark enough, so I have to make the symbols bigger next time. But what I think the best thing I can do for you to show you how black holes operate is to show you three things. I've already shown you the light curve and the state evolution in time. So I just made a little picture. But I could take the same data and show it on the color intensity diagram, so this looks like what the radio astronomers want to see. And then I can show you with the spectral parameters how the energy divides between the power law and the disk. So here are all my red X's. The patterns become more obvious for 1550 and other sources because I have more of a mixture of states. But the thermal state lies on a horizontal track by and large. There's a little bit of curvature at the end. And I would say something like 15% of the luminosity will come out in the power law, 85 in the disk, before I break out of it into something I'm going to say is not the thermal state anymore. But this is, on the energy diagram, where all these lie, and the same data that lies here on the color intensity diagram. But this is where the rewards of looking at an uncoupled model then can be probed. This is where we're asking, how do these two components couple? And that's how I read this. There's a horizontal branch called the thermal state, where energy is free to flow into the accretion disk. And it can flow all at once up to 0.2 eddingtons, and it curves up at the end, very friendly to a thermal continentization idea that's forced by the disk. The flares in this source proceed from this endpoint and go up here. I don't know why you can see the greens from back there. But all the greens are up here. All the high-frequency QPOs are up here. Sorry, the triangle.
Is green there? Is anything there?
John, it's only barely better for the rest of us.
Yeah,
it's very fine. You're not particularly missing there. It looks better on my thing here.
They always say that. I always look on my screen.
I'll remake these. But what I would like to do is publish all these for like 20 black holes. I mean, someday we'll stick them in AppJ, but I'm talking about for you guys to be able to sit and just go through them, right? If you want 20 of these things, how common? Does this look like a Fender diagram? Well, you'll want to like go through all of them and answer that question for all of them. And how does the energy flow for different sources? You can just look at these plots and read them. And this is a way of sort of getting a viewpoint that allows you to ask questions about states. So if we just had this source, this would be very friendly to a linear M dot driven system for states.
Yeah, Ron, temporarily you kind of want to just move along to the right and then turn out to the left. Is that actually how it happens, or is it?
That's what was expected from an M dot.
Trying to tie those two lines.
No, it does. That's how it happens for this source. But then I'll show you the next source. There are a whole bunch of triangles right in here. There's one triangle way up here. And the bolometric luminosity is a little more less organized. This is the worst source. If I look at this horizontal track, the X's, the red X's, and I say, how does the disk behave in terms of dividing energy between the power law and the disk? This is the worst source in the complexity of stuff here. But similarly, it goes to the point of about 0.2 eddingtons and then starts turning up. But
the dot part of that diagram that is most concerned to me is if the left-hand one, where you look at a single hard color and see red, green, and yellow all at the same value.
Yeah.
The
Wait a minute, wait,
3.4
wait. You say, you see red, green, and yellow.
Right. So that when people plot hard color and say that tells you something about the spectral state, this object says that if your scheme is correct, it's in fact a very ambiguous description of the spectral state.
This is...
Well, saying hard color can be any of those three spectral states.
If someone asked me, does hard color uniquely identify the source, I would say no.
Yeah, but that's true.
This, however, is the worst source. And it was this diagram that prompted Homan, after supplements, to say there are more primary variables than M, A, and M dot, A star and M dot. And it was this diagram that we put out that basically said the same thing. There's no linear progression here anymore about what happens in terms of energy divide, and there's no organized relationship here where luminosity is an easy function of hardness on this diagram. So they see these, they drew in the timelines and saw all these branching things and wrote a paper that basically said the branching effect on the color intensity diagram shows that there are lots of intermediate conditions and that the source behavior is not a linear progression in M dot. And I think that's true. There is, however, an interesting limit to the Steve-Power law, which I can trace to another property that I think is interesting. But the way that I look at this now is that there are three spectral components fighting for attention. The disk that wants to give thermal emission. There's a jet that wants to come alive and throw matter out of the system and become a player in the energetics. And there's this other component, this Steve-Power law, that wants to come alive and do its thing. And there are zones when all three are seemingly not quite, no one's locked in, and the other two seem to be around. And that causes, you still see the disk, and you get a sort of curvy power law with an index that's in between the 2.5 and the 1.7. And you get weak radio emission, and it's consistent with the idea that some sources struggle in terms of what's going on, and as if all these three things are in some way operating. But this is the worst case. You see the 20 that I eventually make with bigger, darker symbols, and you'll see that this is the worst one.
I'll ask a question. I don't really see from the diagram on the right how you can say that M dot is not going to be a fundamental parameter of the system.
No. I'm just saying it's not sufficient.
You're always not sufficient.
Yes. If M dot were the prime thing driving this thing and to first order the only thing that you care about, then what's the total luminosity? The total luminosity is the sum of x plus y. So I could draw radii here, and there should be a radius where only the power law lives in the first radius. And by the way, the hard state is a vertical axis here. The hard state suggests that all the energy is free to go into whatever mechanism is associated with the jet. So I have free to go this way, free to go that way, and then the strong combinations of things in the Steve-Power law state. But I would expect to be able to draw radii, and inside each radius there'd be only one symbol type. And then I would expect this structure here, so this radius would have only blues going like that. Then I would get into this zone that would go out to that radius. Then I could draw a thing like that. Then it'd be greens living out here.
Well, to do this budget, you really would have to add also the kinetic energy, which you don't have.
Correct. But this thing then is always probabilistically at the low end, so it just pushes it higher.
So now in spectrum,
I'd like to pick up on the remark Arya made, which is that I heartily agree with the comment you made early on that we have to be very careful that the terms we use aren't misleading us. And that is that when you speak about constant The radius there. You're only talking about a constant radiated luminosity.
Yeah.
Okay. That connects to M dot in some like indirect way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we had.
So that we're really speaking about photon luminosity, which may or may not be proportional to M dot.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a good point, and Charles and I and some others had a conversation about this at the end of the session in there. And one problem with these light curves, and I'll just mention that, is if you expect major discontinuities in radiative efficiency between the mechanisms of different states, right? If you expect that for the reasons of kinetic energy and other things, when I see radiation from the hard state, I should infer a larger M dot than I would from the same amount of radiation in the thermal state, because the thermal state is likely to be much more efficient irradiated. Okay? It gives me an expectation of finding discontinuities at state transitions in the X-ray light curve. And I go in that direction because I expect, by the mechanism of the disk instability, the wave of M dot to be rather smooth. Maybe punctuated with a bunch of waves, but in the standard X-ray transient model, I don't expect a whole bunch of discontinuities to be in the proposition to force.
I wouldn't use some squares there.
Well, let me put it this way. If you're forced the two choices, either the profile of M dot is much more, in fact, discontinuous than these plots look, or the radiative efficiency of the state is much more in common than you expect, perhaps, or than is in the literature. Let me put it that way. Tell me which one you favor.
I don't think we want to make assumptions like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's fine.
Okay. I'm going to move.
I'm nervous. I want to take a poll of the audience. We've now gone on for an hour and 35 minutes, and I'm sure that there's a lot more to come still, right? Because we've been basically having this conversation. Mm-hmm. What do you all want to do?
Take a break and resume.
Second.
Take a break and resume.
Ask Ron how long he still needs and get.
Why don't get Ron to do this at 11 tomorrow morning, rather than a discussion and come back to this room?
We could try and book this room tomorrow at 11. I think because we're the only ones, this is the only program giving talks this week, we may be the only ones in the house, so that may be a problem. Okay, I can try. Is that agreeable to you?
Sure, and I essentially finished the whole idea of how to read state, so this is a good stopping.
All these diagrams that I wanted to see, right, with other sources.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to stand up here and show you 20. My goal is to give you 20, but I only had a sampling of a few here. I think I only had one more. That.
Still the same thing. Okay.
No, this is very common here. That is very common there.
But in the thermal state, you always get this. At the high disk bolometric flux, you do get more of the power log. Now I'll ask you the nasty question, but maybe I'll ask you that in private. So why don't we resume?
Stop here.
And I'll try to book this room.